As a member, my desire is to have a strong and reliable supplier of energy. To that end, I want to know if a potential candidate has a vision of building an organization or tearing one down. Changes in bylaws are stated in there that they should be prudent and necessary. Some directors promoted and voted to eliminate bylaws by eliminating competing suppliers to sit on the board. It appeared this was done to maintain a majority. Other than bylaw changes for legal compliance, are you a subscriber to bylaw changes?
Thank you. I don't have a copy of his question, so did you all, we'll start down with District 3, I believe is where we're starting.
Okay. I don't know that the first part of that question, obviously it's build an organization and not to tear one down. Obviously want to do that. I do question the change of bylaws. It's certainly a necessity for the board to be able to change bylaws, but they better be pretty careful in doing that. That concerns me. I don't really understand. Again, I'm an outsider at this point in time. I don't understand what was done there, but it a lot of question marks in my mind as to why the bylaws were changed the way they were changed.
So we routinely, the board of DMEA routinely over my years on the board has changed bylaws. We came up against this conflict of interest bylaw, and it was unworkable. It would have had me, for example, as our representative to Western United Electric Association with it off the board. It would have had our tri-state director off the board if you read it literally. Everyone says, well, you shouldn't read it that way, but that's what it read. And so we put it in the policies. If anything, we made the conflict of interest situation much stricter. And I think, frankly, given the fact that so many bylaws were changed so routinely year after year, that it was a political football. It served the purposes of some people to blow that up and divert attention, divert our ability to push forward with the management audit. It took us a year to decide on to vote the majority in management audit.
The bylaws were changed. Some bylaw changes are housekeeping. They're not significant in nature. But in the bylaw changes I've been involved in, they've been posted on the agenda. They've been part of regular board meetings. This particular bylaw and the issues surrounding it had a tremendous amount of executive session discussion. I don't believe that the members never did have an opportunity to review and comment on the bylaw before it was on the table and passed by the board, and I thought that was appropriate. I voted against it. I think you follow your bylaws, and changes to the bylaws, especially if they are high profile, should have an opportunity for member review and comment before we change it. And I think it was a very political issue on the other side as well, and it was to preserve votes that were needed to push an agenda forward.
Have you answered yet?
No.
Then your turn.
I think I'm next, yes. I think Tony brings up the key point right here, and that is there was an awful lot of executive session surrounding that question. I came to a number of the board meetings when they were dealing with this issue, and it was very difficult from the public's perspective and what you were told in the board meetings to understand what all the issues were. So I would defer to what the board decided only because I don't have any more information on the issue.
District 4? Mr. Yeller, you can go first.
I don't. It doesn't matter, we're at the end. I already have my thoughts. Before you change a bylaw, back in seventh grade, I had a teacher, and he had a plaque up on the wall, and it said, before you take down a fence, first find out why it was first put up. And so before you take down laws from the bylaws, you need to really understand why was it there in the first place. Is it a government law that has changed from the federal or state or local, or is it a business environment, a situation? You need to look at that, and so you need to take it seriously, but things do change, and I've been on many boards that we've had to change bylaws. But I was also with with Kay and I were at the meetings. We could not get into the executive sessions, but we were at the general sessions, and you know, it seemed like it was pretty hasty, and that's just a concern.
Amy? When it comes to serving on the board, probably you have three top priorities, and number one is, of course, to your constituents. That would be the co-op members. Number two would be fiscal responsibility. Number three is conflict of interest. A lot of times where boards get themselves into trouble is when you have maybe not malintent, but not the best interest at heart and not everything transparent. I believe that, yes, you should be able to change bylaws, but when you change any document, you need to be as forthright and public about it and maybe go to the extra ends to publicize what you're doing and why, and to let people understand and have that conversation.
District 3?
We did it.
We did it already, okay. Yeah, I have a hard time.
We can do it again.
Maybe it's an expanded time here. But the next question has been submitted by Virginia and Paul Allen. I have a whole list of them, but I'm only going to ask one of them. So I'm going to hit the one that's at the top of the page. And it says, when the coal mines in the North Fork run out of coal in the next few years, how will that impact the generation of electricity from methane gas?
I've been up to each of the mines and had some of that conversation. I probably get the names of the mines and the methane issue a little bit different, confuse that. But I know one of the mines is already dealing with that issue, and they're working with one of the co-ops over on the Front Range or in the Middle Range to provide power over to Vail or to Aspen. And I think that's great. The second mine, my understanding, has very little methane, so there's nothing to develop. The third mine, which is Elk, okay, a lot of their methane is coming out of the ground on federal land above the mine. So the mine in itself is clean. And I think if you can economically go in there on federal property and capture that methane and burn it, I would certainly look at doing that as long as it's cost competitive against the tri-state wholesale rate.
The coal mine methane is a really interesting potential source of power, but it's got a long ways to go. I'm a big supporter of working responsibly to develop it, but not to go overboard as it being some great panacea. As far as I'm aware, this generator that was opened up last November is only the second one of its kind in the United States, coal mine methane, and each site has a lot of specific challenges to deal with. The generators opened up to great fanfare in November, and then were shut down in January. And as far as I know, they may still be shut down because of the off-gassing issue that was up in the Oxbow mine. I don't know the details on that, but it's a concern. I don't think that we can put all our eggs in the methane basket at this point. It's something that we want to continue to look at developing if it's cost-effective, but it's still a ways out before we can rely on it as a reliable, affordable source of electricity that this co-op can run on.
I agree with those gentlemen said. I think that we need to have a diverse portfolio as possible. I do think it's very interesting, but we need to make sure that we do all of our homework, know what it is, and not jump off a ship and then not have a safety net. We need to keep our rates sustainable, and making sure that we have lasting resources is important.
Building?
Like Ms. Kennedy said, I also believe in a diverse energy portfolio where you have various sources that you can pull from. You don't put all your eggs in one basket. You have various sources out there, various prices and rates, and so methane is just part of the portfolio. There's many people that rely on jobs up in Delta County, you know, I think we need to be looking at that and monitoring it and utilizing the resources as possible.
Thank you. I think I saw you, Mr. Marston.
Yes. So I have an advantage over several of the challengers because we've met extensively with Tom Vessels, who's the developer of the 3-megawatt system up at Oxbow. And Tom has also pushed this Senate Bill 252 because it makes coal mine methane a renewable energy source. To answer Virginia's question, Tom says that once the mines close, the methane supply will be more dependable. Why it's shut down now at Oxbow is because they've had a terrible situation and they just didn't want him operating. But the end of the mine, they seal it off and it would continue to give off methane. I think it's probably, you know, talk about putting all your eggs in one basket. 95% of our eggs are in the tri-state basket. And that's a basket we have absolutely no control over. We're one of 44 on that board, and it's run top-down by management. We should be looking for as many alternatives as we can, and the most hopeful one is the coal mine methane.
Mr. Lund?
I guess I have an unfair advantage in that a little bit, too. Yes, that methane will be available after they shut down, will actually be cleaner. What they say cleaner, able to generate more electricity from it, because during mining they have to be sure that that is diluted to a pretty low level for the safety of the miners. So there will be a higher quality methane available after they shut down mining, but it will decay through time. Depending on how big the mine is or how much they've disturbed underground, there will be decay through time. So, yeah, that's not a basket you can put your eggs in indefinitely.
Thank you. The next question is Mr. Allen. Given the current drought and its projected continuation, how risky is it for DMEA to extend itself further with hydroelectric projects? And we'll start with Mr. Elder.
Well, the hydroelectric project is a long-term project. Even the payoff is over 20 years. So short-term droughts, you need to look way beyond the drought that we have and the lower water flow coming through the canal. And so I think we still need to look at it as a long-term project, and the hydroelectric plans, and we're talking to Jim Hennigan. It's a very solid, well-thought-out project that has been built, and so the drought is a short-term issue, I hope. I have a farm, and I'm dealing with my neighbors trying to figure out who gets what water. So my neighbor's getting his water right now, or getting my water, so he can water his fields, and then I'll get his next week. So, so I think we still need to keep moving on with hydroelectric.
Ms. Campbell?
Again, I think a diverse portfolio is very important. Just as there were a lot of naysayers in 1974 at the Dallas Water Project, and known as the Ridgeway Dam, it was imperative to the growth and sustainability of this valley. We are in a drought season. As we look at weather patterns, they go up, they go down. Let's hope that they stay up. But I think it's very viable for the future, and we need to continue projects of that nature.
And the pen points to me here. This is a subject I could probably bore you to tears on the water rights and the seniority of the water rights. Those water rights that they are using that belong to the Uncompahgre Valley Water Users Association are very early rights. So even though there's a drought, there's not, how should I say, those are pretty reliable. Now, you folks that farm under Uncompahgre Valley Water Users know that you're being cut back some this year, but it's not something last year and this year. It's not something that is a long-term problem or possibility or probability. I shouldn't say possibility ever. Not a long-term probability. Part of the problems there are some of the environmental issues with releasing water down the river. So I think it's a great idea. I think it's a great thing to put some money back into the economy, into the local economy, put some money back for the farmers, essentially another crop.
It's, if you sit in the boardroom, you realize it's all risk. Like Tri-State, in an arbitrary and capricious way, has changed our rate structure so that, for example, our coal mines, if we passed it through to them, would be paying 10% or more as a rate increase, because Tri-State has decided to, for whatever reason, punish the largest, steadiest users of electricity and to reward the users who use electricity in a sporadic, peaking way. And they've done this because the majority of the board are small, rural, agricultural co-ops with heavy irrigation loads. and the majority, and that really helps them. It's a transfer of wealth from co-ops like ours to co-ops on the high plains. So it's all risky. It's risky in a human sense to be with Tri-State because of their arbitrary nature. It's risky if you depend on water. It's risky if you depend on coal mine methane. And the biggest risk was the people who founded DMEA 75 years ago.
Just as far as the hydroelectric projects, we've looked at that extensively, that run different scenarios, given different flows in the canal and drought scenarios, and they will still work. The bigger issue, though, is that you know, when we look at wanting to bump from 5% local distributed energy to 10% or more, some board members have pushed for 50%, Tri-State's on the hook for supplying us with 100% of our energy at any moment in time, and that's a tremendous responsibility. They take it seriously. That our hydro projects are great. They contribute to Tri-State's overall summer peak load, so they work. But if we were to go off on our own, as some board members have said, and self-generate and break our contract with Tri-State, those hydroelectric generators only running for 7 months out of the year. So where's that backup power going to come from, and how much is it going to cost? We've actually looked at potentially providing our own backup power, a gas pipe. It's not economical at this time. It may be in the future, but we're not there yet. And those are the big issues that this board needs to deal with.
Yeah, I think you have to maybe not worry so much about the weather, but worry about the economy. Look at the economics of these projects. And whether we build, you know, another hydro project or we build 10 more hydro projects, I think what you really need to do, you need to analyze what is the cost, what is the economic impact to DMEA. My understanding is the South Canal project cost $18 million. You can build a lot of things for $18 million, and you can run them 365 days out of the year. The only reason that I would want to see us get involved in another hydro project, if, like the one that we have, if it's generating costs on a six-month period of water availability is lower than the wholesale power rate from Tri-State, I'd say build all of them that you can, because it helps DMEA. Thank you.
And the next on, and I'm not sure I'm reading this name correctly, it's James, I can read that one.
Yes.
Ditmore?
Yes. I'd like to know your position on wind energy and the potential for construction of wind farms in western Colorado. What is your position on that?
We have actually done some analysis of wind resources, and over here in the mountain areas, the wind is just, sometimes it blows like hell, but it's intermittent, and so it's not a real cost-effective resource, and that's why you don't see any wind farms over here on the western slope. Sometimes up on the high mountain ridges, you'll get a steady wind, but there's no transmission. So it's not really looked at this point as a viable, larger-scale renewable resource for our area.
I think I would agree with exactly what Tony said. My source of data, though, was the lab over in Golden, the National Renewable Energy Lab over there. I contacted them. They have a number of wind maps to show areas where, you know, it's economical to build wind farms, and they don't show western Colorado as being one of those areas. I happened to drive down through Texas just last week, saw a 500 megawatt wind farm, 350 windmills, and they were just beating the power of the wind to death. And, you know, if we had something like that, again, if it supports what you would buy, and you could get a deal on it, and it was less than that wholesale power rate from Tri-State, I'd say absolutely.
If research doesn't support it, that it's not viable, then I would not go that direction. I don't have quite the data that the gentleman do, but I think if it were viable, it would be researched, and there would be free enterprise trying to develop it. Mr. Elder?
Okay, back in the 80s when I had my solar energy company, I worked with CERI, Solar Energy Research Institute in Golden, and like Kay was saying, they have wind maps, and I was living in Denver, so I don't remember specifically, but if the wind maps would show that there's it's viable for sustainable, reliable wind, they would be putting up windmills. And I don't remember that as an issue. There are some corridors up in near Laramie, Wyoming, certainly out in Palm Springs, California, and some other parts in the country. But not out here in the Western Slope that seems to be viable from my memory back in the 1980s. That's been 30 years ago. But
okay, thank you. I don't know which way your pen is pointing, so where would you?
Well, I know which way it's pointing, but I can't remember if I turned it or not.
We'll let you go first anyway.
Okay. Really nothing more to add. The wind maps, the wind basically doesn't blow in western Colorado in these mountains and valleys to be able to support the wind generation, wind farms. A simple matter of economics, I believe. What we do have in this area is a tremendous opportunity for the micro hydro, for the low head hydro. That's something that I don't know, again, I don't know that it's exactly reliable, but it is much more beneficial, or much, much bigger potential, I shouldn't say more beneficial, much bigger potential in this area than the wind is.
So, maybe except in this room at this moment, there's just not much wind in western Colorado, but if I could expand on the question, it is whether we can move into local generation, and what irritates me is that Tri-State has already spent $75 million in Kansas on a plant that most probably will never be built, rather than ask co-ops like DMEA to incrementally increase how much power we generate locally, whether it's from small hydro or from solar or from biomass. There's lots of standing dead trees, sadly, out there. But Tri-State has no intention of ever setting its co-ops, including DMEA, free to self-generate and therefore create an economic base. It's the ultimate in shop at home, and they fight us at every turn.
I believe that everybody has dealt with that question, and so we will start with the closing statements, and we'll start down with the South region first, and I believe that Mr. Heinschel goes first.
Thank you. Once again, I'd like to thank everybody for coming. I'd like to thank DMEA for hosting this, and I would like to thank the League of Women Voters for putting this together for DMEA. When the ballots come out next week, there's a couple things I'd like you to keep in mind. I don't profess to know everything these board members know. You know, I haven't been in those executive sessions. And so what I bring to the table is something different than what they have. And I have 40 years in the power industry. I have worked Craig Coal Mine. I was the project engineer on the rebuild of the Nucla coal facility. I have worked at all three of the hydros that Colorado Ute owned, which is Ouray, Tacoma, and Ames down in the San Juans, and we were rebuilding those 30 years ago. Thank you.
Mr. Prendergast?
I think Kay would make a great board member in six more years. I've been a board member for 6 years. In that time, I've been the board president for 1 year. I've served as a chairman of the Public Relations Committee and currently chair the General Manager Evaluation Committee of the South Canal Hydro Committee. So I provide quite a bit of leadership, I believe, on this board. I have taken the courses that the National Rural Electric Cooperative Association offers. I've become a credentialed cooperative director, and I believe I'm the only member on this board who's has the board leadership certificate. I'm halfway through the potential term of 12 years that we can serve, and I feel like you've all made an investment in me, and I would like to continue returning that and serving on this board and solving problems we have before us for at least one more term and possibly two. So thank you, and I would appreciate your vote. Be a vote for responsible leadership.
I think we will go to District 3, and I believe Mr. Marston, you go first.
So I don't know if I'm very experienced at 18 years or if I'm dead wood. You'll have to decide that. But I have three things I want to get done if I'm reelected. I'm term limited. This would be my last term. I also think I'm sort of age limited. It would be my last term if I weren't term limited. Broadband. Virginia mentioned the coal mines closing. It's 1,000 jobs in my end of the woods. We need broadband, and DMEA can be instrumental in providing that broadband. And I think of broadband as bringing in an airport, an interstate highway. It's a very basic utility. And the second thing is Tri-State. We need to not break our contract with Tri-State, but we need to reason with Tri-State the way Don Corleone would reason with Tri-State, or Tony Soprano. I mean, but they have us in a vice grip, and that has to be weakened. And the third thing, or maybe the first thing, is the management assessment. That's caused a lot of turmoil, but it's very necessary. We're a 75-year-old organization, and it's necessary that we put ourselves, the board and the staff, under the microscope.
Thank you. Mr. Lund?
Thank you. I would like also to thank the attendees and DMEA for hosting this and the League of Women Voters for facilitating it. There was an article in the Montrose Daily Press early on in this that mentioned me, said something about agenda free in District 3. I guess that's not, how should I say, basically that's true. I have no agenda, but that's not totally true because my agenda are the members, ratepayers of DMEA. I certainly oppose Senate Bill 252. If it happens, I think that we can work with it, that there are things that can be done, but it is going to be an added expense. My goal is low-cost and reliable energy, electricity for the members of the co-op. I really questioned the wisdom in doing something like that.
Thank you. I believe Ms. Kennedy goes first. You go, Ms. Kennedy.
There's two promises I can make you tonight. First promise is, regardless of the issue, I can't please everyone. The other promise I can make you is I will do my homework, I will read the documents, and I will give you the time of day. That's what I can promise you. I can't guarantee all kinds of things. It's a board of nine. But you have my time, you have my ear, and I would like to develop expertise over the years. So, it's about being open, honest, and being able to stand up, ask questions when they're uncomfortable, but doing it in a courteous and respectful manner, and not doing anything backdoor, and serving the co-op to the best of its need, and growing all of it for a better region. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Elder?
Okay. For the past several weeks, I've been out walking the district and talking to people and knocking on doors and asking them what are their issues and concerns. And here's what they told me. They said that they want a board member with business experience. Well, I have 32 years as experience owning businesses. They want a board member with engineering background. I went to college for mechanical engineering and owned a solar energy engineering firm for 12 years. They want somebody that understands utilities. Well, my solar company competed directly against Public Service Company of Colorado for a dozen years. They want a board member that can read a P&L balance sheet and a cash flow statement. I'm a fiduciary financial advisor, and I've consulted with hundreds of businesses. They want someone to be a good financial steward. Well, I manage $58 million for my clients on a daily basis with my business. So who do you trust? Who do you trust to keep the rates low? Who do you trust to keep to manage your local utility? Who do you trust to be a good steward of your utility dollars? So I have the experience and knowledge to be an excellent board member. I'd appreciate your vote. Thanks.
Thank you.